Gonna give you a little intro music. Welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. With me, Carrie Cassidy. She is on the front lines of exposing the cabal. You're blowing apart, like, there are security levels. I think of it as, like, security levels, yet in the CIA, it's, like, top secret, super top secret. Everything's compartmentalized. But what you're doing is you're finding whistleblowers and at all different, who know different pieces of the puzzle, and you're having them explain everything to the other people, you know? How did you get involved in this?
And thanks for having me on the show. It's a kind of a long story, but just to make it as short as possible. I was a frustrated filmmaker in Hollywood, and I was at the time, before I started Camelot with my former partner, Bill Ryan, I was trying to package as an independent producer sci-fi movies that would contain the truth as I saw it and the messages that ultimately became the subject matter for people that I interviewed in Project Camelot. And I was running up against like a glass ceiling, you might call it. I wasn't part of the old boys network. And so when I brought a very good project such as the Wingmakers story to producers, and I brought it to the story people of those producers, such as Ridley Scott, James Cameron, and Kathleen Kennedy, who worked with Spielberg, I basically couldn't get past go, as you say. And, so that led me to decide to pick up a consumer-grade camcorder and go out and start interviewing actually speakers at, I thought, UFO conferences just as a lark in the initial stages to see what would happen if I put the camera in front of them, because I had started going to those conferences. I saw the speakers were very, very intelligent. Many had written books. Some were whistleblowers. And I wanted to get their stories out, but at the same time, I also noticed that a lot of the people, aside from people that actually were what we call experiencers or contactees, never talked about actually seeing UFOs themselves. So I decided to go around a conference just sort of sticking a camera in their face and asking them if they'd seen a UFO. And I do have a short film that's available on Camelot and has been there since pretty much day one. And it's part of what we call the old site. That's exactly what I did. And I talked to people like Rich Dolan, Jim Mars, Peter, what's his last name? Anyway, Rendlesham Forest story and a bunch of other people. And it's a fun little documentary. But in the travels, I met up with Bill Ryan. He was one of my subjects. I was interviewing him because he was a webmaster for the Serpo.org project. And that was it was a DIA, so-called anonymous release of information that was about a planet called Serpo and supposedly around 12 astronauts that went there. And the end of the Close Encounters movie is actually depicting that scenario. Bill had volunteered to be the webmaster, so he wasn't the principal on that project, but he was the only person who was the public face at the time. So I went to a conference. I asked him for an interview. He accepted. I walked in with my little consumer-grade camcorder, and he had just been interviewed by a whole film crew with lights and cameras and the whole nine yards. And so he's looking at me like I'm out of my mind and why is he even bothering? But basically, we had a great interview. I put it on YouTube, and it really had a lot of traction. We ended up hitting it off and being good friends, and we decided to keep in touch. And I went to Europe, to Egypt with William Henry and Jordan Maxwell as part of a trip that they were doing in search of Atlantis in Egypt. And I decided to stop over in England because I wanted to see the power places such as Stonehenge, and Bill said he would take me to Tintagel, which was one of the former homes of King Arthur, or at least purported to be. So we went to Tintagel, and I had a lot of past life recall at that time, around the time of memories around the time of King Arthur. And we both were very inspired to just create the idea for Camelot right then and there, which was to be a platform to provide whistleblowers from above top secret a place to report their experiences and their time in black projects, etc. And we had no idea whether we'd be successful or not. As it happened, we kind of hit the ground running, and we became a grassroots movement, and we started traveling the world with just, a small camera, and just the two of us, and the style kind of became really notorious because I put a camera in front of somebody's face and talked to them for 2 hours minimum, and that was unusual at the time. It's more common now. It kind of caught on after that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I got it started.
And what started happening, I was following your work from the beginning. I was like, this is crazy, like people go on TV and they do Leno interviews for like 7 minutes. I'm a comic, so that's kind of my reference. But then podcasts start happening, and then you start like really finding out what people know. And what you started to uncover was something called the Secret Space Program. That runs, we know of, the public has access to knowing of an agency called Space Command and an agency called DARPA. That's what they put out, but then behind those two public faces of those things, you started really uncovering a whole bunch of layers. What is the Secret Space Program?
Well, I mean, that's kind of just a moniker that some of our whistleblowers were using, so we kind of adopted it. It refers to the secret government, ultimately, that is behind the scenes on planet Earth, and it seems to be where they put all their time and money, for all intents and purposes. In other words, they have an agenda, an overall agenda, the secret government. In other words, it's not just to govern Earth, but it is to plan for contingencies, for once they realized that we were not alone, so to speak, that they need to plan in a military fashion for invasion, possible invasion from other species, all of which was already happening. And they started making deals for technology back within the Eisenhower administration. That's very well known. And so that became the beginnings of the secret space program. And then on top of it, the end of World War II with Nazi Germany, the Nazis, as many people will know, were brought over to the US, also to England, and Russia got a few of them. Some went underground in Argentina and Antarctica. Those are the primary places where they disappeared to at the end of World War II. That became sort of the backbone of the secret space program and the black projects that are we know and love, so to speak, right now. And so it's really made up of a drive to go out, terraform other planets, become a force to be reckoned with in interstellar space, and in the event that something should happen to Earth, to relocate to other viable planets, to also, in light of the overpopulation, possibly create places where they can, have more population. And also to create this, another part of their agenda is a very strong part, which involves what, well, actually, it's two-pronged. One is longevity, and the other is what we call humanity 2.0 or 3.0, and it's really more accurately called 3.0, I believe. And that is all about creating a race of super soldiers, in essence, that are using things like artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, and augmenting them, their intelligence, their you know, their ability to they're very, you know, beyond the six senses, you know, the super. Actually, we have superpowers that are part of our makeup naturally. But what they want to do is, once they discovered we have those tendencies and those potentials, they wanted to jumpstart all of that. And so that's all part of their Humanity 3.0 program.
Yeah, it's like after, so it was like Project Paperclip, everybody knows about that, where we took all the Nazi scientists, but and we like had a couple of them, like token lower level scientists, and we gave them to the Nuremberg trial. So it's like, look, you know, human testing is evil. We can't have that. So let's, like, do a big speech in the Nuremberg trial and then hang a bunch of them. And it's like, yeah, we got those Nazis. But really, when it comes to, like, the top of the pyramid scientists there, we took them into our secret programs underground. You know, what's interesting is it's very well known that Hitler was also really into the occult, part of the Thule Society. And apparently they were really into contacting the Andromedon, the planet Andromedon, and getting and starting a new age of enlightenment based on free energy technology, which sounds great, but somehow there got to be like a depopulation thing. And do you know what I'm saying? Like, what's, do you know about the Thule Society and what their original goal is, and what, how did it get messed up?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, first of all, there are two writers who have written substantial books on the subject. One is Jim Mars, and the other is Joseph Farrell, and I've interviewed both of them, so I do highly recommend those interviews, as well as the books that they've written about this subject. But, you know, basically what happens is the Thule, you're talking about a contact with the Vril Society, that, sorry.
What's the difference between is, the Thule Society
is,
and the Vril?
Is
what's
a contact with Aldebaran, a race of beings from Aldebaran that they made contact with, which in essence helped them develop technology, even flying saucers that were seen during World War II and became known as the... what are they called? I'm sorry. It's just the words going out of my head. But at any rate, sightings that were made during World War II of their various craft. They also developed at that time, with the help of the race from Aldebaran, what is known as the Nazi Bell.
Yeah, and that looks like a... like a flying saucer that's like shaped like the Liberty Bell.
Actually, the Nazi Bell is a time travel machine in essence. It basically allows one to create a portal and go interdimensional.
Wow. I want to take this off. Also, I was looking at your interview with Bill Wood, who was, you know, speaking of this kind of extra-dimensional stuff, he was a part of SEAL Team 9 between 1992 and 2000, and he was basically going around Iraq, finding small buildings, blowing them to hell, then they would meet little nomadic tribes and seem to make friends, and then another SEAL team would blow them to hell, and then another, like, it was just like killing a bunch of people before 9/11, and then he started, which is just seems bananas, and it just seems like he's pumping chaos energy into the atmosphere. And then he starts talking about this looking glass technology. What is this looking glass technology that he was describing?
Well, he was really talking about something that had already been disclosed to us by Dan Burish. And I have a number of interviews, actually, with Dan Burish, who was already on the circuit, in essence, but he was widely misunderstood, it seemed to me, and to Bill, my former partner. And we split up over 4.5 years ago, but initially started the project together. So back in the early days, we interviewed Dan Burish, and like I say several times, one of our interviews is called Stargate Secrets, I believe, and it is all about that subject. But the Looking Glass is a technology that allows them, or it came from the ETs, and allows humans to see the future, and not to be confused with what's called the Yellow Cube, which also allows one to do that, but in a slightly different way.
There's this guy that I'm going to have on my podcast the first week of January, second week of January, called Andrew DiBishago. I think you know that guy. He described something similar, like he called it a chronovisor. And what that is same thing, like it's like some kind of glass plate or whatever, and you can see images of the future or past, you know? Is that the same stuff?
Well, I mean, it's not. I don't think the technology is the same, what he's referring to as the Looking Glass. My understanding of Looking Glass is that that it involves quite a large structure as part of its putting a part of what it goes together, a bit like the Stargate in the TV show Stargate.
Right.
And that it also involves a computer technology, or possibly might be a software. Burish was understandably vague when describing it, but judging, I know Andy Bishago, and we were in touch with Andy before he ever went public. We also interviewed him on our television pilot that is available on the internet called Shadow Operations. But the chronovisor seems to be slightly different.
This guy, we're jumping all over the place. I'm trying to put this tapestry together. But also what keeps coming up is Dulce Air Force Base seems to be a place that the government and aliens are kind of working together in this foreign exchange program of, and there's also Thule's, is it Thule Society or Tool Society, and Vril aliens there, and they're cloning people. What's the Dulce Air Force Base connection in all this?
Well, it's called the Dulce Base. I personally have not heard it referred to as the Dulce Air Force Base. That's kind of an interesting way of
terming. I heard that the Air Force...
It's underground.
Right.
It's a huge underground base. And within it, it's actually, if people want to know more about it, first of all, there's a terrific amount of information on the web, mostly disclosed by somebody named Branton. But beyond that, Sean David Morton wrote a book because he has had a whistleblower who died or was about to die, and bequeathed his sort of records to Sean under the condition that he would put it in a fictional form, so, and also not disclose his identity or that of his family, so the family who were still going to be living would stay safe. This man ran, for all intents and purposes, ran Area 51 for many years. And the story that Sean has written is basically all true from this whistleblower. And it involves talking about Dulce in some detail. There are other people who have gotten into the Dulce story as well. Anthony Sanchez is another one of the people that I've interviewed a number of times. And he has written a book called UFO Highway. He had a disclosure witness, a secret witness called the Colonel, who disclosed a certain amount about the Dulce base. And although I think there was some disinfo in his relating of information, but for the most part, it covers a lot of good stuff. But Dulce base is a place where they notoriously experimented on humans. And my interviewee, Captain Mark Richards from the Secret Space Program, he and his father were part of a raid on the Dulce base to rescue those humans that were being experimented on and, in essence, tortured over long periods of time. And so he took part in that and has also written a report on that raid. So it is not an Air Force base per se.
Was that raid authorized? So basically, was it a president that was heard about Dulce Base and they were like, we can't have human experimenting, we got to go and rescue those people? Or was Captain Mark Richards involved, and this happened in like 1979, was he involved in some kind of clandestine raid on the base? Was it organized by a president or anybody? Who put that
together?
Well,
behind the scenes, what we're talking about was that Mark Richards and his father went by the notorious name the Dutchman, and was very highly regarded within the secret space program. They were part of a secret raid, yes, on the Dulce base. Now, Phil Schneider, I think, was also involved in some kind of shootout there. I am not sure or convinced in any way that they're both talking about the same raid. In other words, there were more than one sort of fallout, but whether presidents were involved at that juncture, I'm not sure. We do have a witness that Linda Moulton Howe and Rich Dolan disclosed at the conference in Washington, D.C., the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure, who was an intelligence agent who apparently was also involved in some kind of raid on the Dulce base in some capacity. Again, whether he was talking about the same raid Mark was involved in, I don't know, but he is somebody who came forward and has quite a stunning testimony in that regard.
I keep hearing about a few alien races on the base. I hear about Greys, I hear about Dracos, and I hear about Vril. Is that your understanding, these three alien races, from what I can read?
Well, no. I mean, I think... I'm not sure what you mean by Vril. I don't think that that's the same as what we know of as the Vril Society. I don't think that those are the same ETs. There definitely is a large contingent of Greys there. There are reptilians, what we know of as reptilians. Not necessarily, you know, there is a distinction to be made between Grey, what they call reptilians, and Dracos. And the Dracos coming from the Draco galaxy, and at least one race of reptilians believes themselves to be indigenous to Earth and interested in taking Earth back. Now, this base is also run by a particular being that seems to be at least match closely enough the information I've gotten regarding what's called the Archons. And he considers himself to be a royal, a member of royalty, and is not the same race as the Greys, and he was running the place. For all I know, he's still running the place, because the base did not shut down after the raids. And according to Mark Richards' testimony, even though they did rescue a number of humans, the ETs had the capability of just going back and abducting them again, so that it was almost a useless gesture. Although, you know, I'm sure that they must have been able to, rescue us at least some and put a dent in the situation that was going on there. I mean, the trouble is that base exists on our planet along with many other bases because deals have been made with those ETs to allow them to do business that way with us, and in exchange for technology.
And there are a lot of like cloning going on, so they could like abduct one person and then clone them like 100 times, right? Is that true? Like that we see these like vats of like a glass womb where clones are made, right?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I believe that there are definitely clones being made. Where they're being made and under what circumstances, that's not quite so clear. I mean, there are a lot of people out there that are talking about things that they get maybe, or they think they get psychically, or they think they get in other ways. That's a different kind of process, and I have to say that there can be a lot of disinfo in that vein. I don't tend to necessarily believe those people. I can say that there is and this comes also from the James of the Wingmakers, who I interviewed. and wingmakers.com is the website, who is in touch with a group from the Lyra constellation. He talks about a matrix, another matrix, which is a channeling matrix that exists around our planet.
Have you
that channeling matrix is responsible for deceiving a great deal of especially, you know, what you might call New Agers, into thinking that they have the truth about something or other. And it may just be a deceptive program put in place by the Galactic Federation.
So in other words, they put out false psychic information on a metaphysical level to confuse psychics?
Yeah.
Interesting. Some of this stuff about Dulce, have you heard of a guy called Donald Marshall?
Not sure.
He
sounds a bit familiar, but not sure.
I've been trying to get him on my podcast forever, but he basically claims that his mom was a basically high-class hooker of the Illuminati, and he was set up to be a diddle kid, and then he started to avoid getting molested by the elite. He started singing songs, and then those songs showed up in, like, A-level, like, the top pop artists of in Hollywood and stuff. And anyway, he claims a lot. He claims that he wakes up in a clone body somewhere else, and then they have this, like, stadium where all the clones get together. So I don't know. His stuff is really crazy. I'm not sure. You know, that's the thing about all this. You know, you hear from different whistleblowers, and you never know who's feeding you disinformation or who's completely insane or who hears bits and pieces and then they want to put their own spin on it. How do you kind of funnel through all this crazy information about the secret space program and know who's telling you the truth?
Well, there are a number of ways that we do it at Camelot. One of the ways is to triangulate information the way an intelligence agent would who works for the CIA or whatever. Basically, we take three or more witnesses with the same information who don't know each other, who come from completely different places and directions, and if they all tend to say the same thing about something, then we consider that worth investigating further and having some credibility. What has happened, because I've been doing this now for nearly 9 years, is that I've gotten a lot of corroborating testimony from completely disparate contacts. And the other thing is that, I am an intuitive, and that has served me very well in Camelot, proved to be accurate in many cases, and I've come to rely on it over time. Another way is, first of all, I was a heavy investigator into this sector, and in fact writing sci-fi screenplays. Working on one called Project Moondust, as a matter of fact, right before I got into Camelot. So I did a lot of investigation on my own, on the internet, and also I studied, you know, Eastern philosophy and did a lot of meditation in my younger years. So that has also helped me to be discerning and to be able to tell what resonates and what doesn't. On top of it, I am a contactee, so I do get my own information and downloads, you might call it. And lastly, I would say that, interestingly enough, because of the technique that I employ in terms of putting a camera in front of somebody's face and leaving it there, more or less, just to cut between me and the person, It creates a dynamic in which you're much more able to evaluate whether you're being told the truth or not. And then on top of it, there's a sense that because a lot of these witnesses are military and you can trace their military backgrounds, they don't have any reason to come forward because one gets ridiculed wildly. They are putting themselves and their children and their families and loved ones at risk. of even being killed for their pictures oftentimes. So when you've got somebody under those circumstances giving you information, and then the other part of that is that we get to know our witnesses very well over time. It's not just a one-shot deal in most cases, although I do get information back channeled from people who never go on video, never go on audio, and stay secret because they're too afraid to come forward in any other way. But they do still communicate with me. And because I've been doing this for so long, you know, it's like a body of work that has now been verified over and over again from various angles.
Right.
Speaking of another interesting aspect to this whole debacle is finance. You know, we know that the Federal Reserve kind of pumps out phony money, a fiat currency, and our Federal Reserve is owned by foreign banks. And apparently, you know, information coming out from people like Benjamin Fulford are saying that, you know, the rest of the world is really sick of this secret government, you know, spreading chaos energy in the world by just blowing up a bunch of people in Iraq before 9/11 and then using the 9/11 excuse to blow up more people in Iraq and Afghanistan and steal oil and steal real rare earth minerals from Afghanistan. So it seems like, you know, people are starting to wake up to this whole thing. But at the crux of it are two people that you interviewed, and they both hate each other, and they both disagree with each other, and both claim that the other are disinformation agents. And those two people are Neil Keenan and Karen Hudes. And so I called Karen Hudes one time after talking to Reverend Kevin Annette, and then Reverend Kevin Annette is this guy who is trying to arrest, he got the last pope to retire, and now he's trying to get this pope to retire. He's basically exposing pedophilia in the Catholic Church. And Karen Hudes, I called her up because she said that guy's a fraud. And then this is a weird story, but after talking to Karen Hudes, she basically yelled at me, told me I didn't know what I was talking about, told me where do I get my information, I don't research. And then that night, I had a very intense, some kind of weird visions I had, like with a lot of weird Illuminati imagery. And full disclosure, I had a marijuana brownie as well. But I've had marijuana brownies a lot of times, and I didn't have this crazy intense experience of seeing only this Illuminati imagery. Pyramids and like Thule Society imagery. It was really intense, and I felt like Karen Hudes was trying to show me something psychically. I've never had that experience before in my life, so I just want to, I've never even talked about this before. It's been very weird to talk about, but what's your take on Karen Hudes and Neil Keenan's beef and what they're both saying? Can you summarize it?
Oh, well, no, I wouldn't pretend to summarize actually Keenan, to tell you the truth, although I have talked to him and I have attempted to sort of, well, I actually have done a fair amount of investigation of his work and so on. I mean, that's quite a long saga. Now, they're completely different, and I have interviewed Karen Hudes, as many people will know, a number of times, and she has come across as quite a lovely person. I do think that in some cases at this time, she may be being misled. Some of the disclosures I've heard of late don't necessarily match. I think that they may be more hearsay or maybe someone feeding her information that, you know, in other words, she doesn't really have a way of verifying. But her initial coming forward and her background as a lawyer, you know, working for the, I believe it was it's either the IMF or the World Bank. I get them mixed up, but.
The World Bank.
And, you know, and dealing with what, you know, we know of as the, these projects that are put in place and high, you know, and basically the IMF then goes in and takes over. And all of that is information that has been put forth by what's known as the economic hitman. So so she was blowing the whistle on deals that were being made that were basically sort of one hand sort of, you know, I don't know what you call it. Basically, you know, God, what do you call it? You know, one hand, I don't know, back channel feeding the other. What I'm saying here is that she basically uncovered a specific cases where she was finding monies were not going where they were supposed to go, that people, the depositors and investors weren't vetted properly, et cetera, et cetera. And she ultimately began to go down a rabbit hole in terms of the economic situation, and find out that there was a lot more going on than she realized. Now, interestingly enough, in her case, she stayed naive for a very long time. I mean, she worked for the World Bank for something ridiculous, like, I don't know, 15 years or more, as I recall. And so this is where, you know, it gets kind of crazy, because one has to wonder how it is she stayed in the dark quite so long. When she came forward, they tried to fire her. And she's a fighter, and she knew what she knew, and so she decided to basically become a whistleblower. And ultimately, they were hard-pressed to be able to make the firing stick, although ultimately she did leave. So her, that's kind of her side of the question. Now, she has since then made a number of claims that are not necessarily proving true. But that's true of Benjamin Fulford. You know, a lot of these people get put into this sector. They start investigating one thing, and then they think they can pretty much figure out everything else. And that isn't often the case. And so, unfortunately, they end up getting, you know, sort of wrong information. But there's a large contingent of people that believe, you know, that, like, oh, bankers are being arrested, and, you know, there are troops, you know, Chinese troops in Washington, D.C., who are spotted there legitimately, and other things going on, which she has reported as well. So I'm not saying she's wrong either all the time, but I am saying that apparently, you know, some of her things about, especially about ET races, are simply things that she doesn't know anything about, and that she's being fed information. And it doesn't sound true to me based on my background. So there's that situation. Neil Keenan is another matter. He is someone who came forward and wanted to free up these monies, and is talking a lot of dealing with, well, the gold in the Philippines to some degree, but also the gold that's held by the Indonesians. And he was a representative who is, in a sense, an entrepreneur, a free agent, who was employed by the, I think it's Sukarno, or Sukarto, I guess it's the lawyer that came after Sukarno in Indonesia. And he was actually asked to become a sort of an errand boy, to take these certificates that represent a huge amount of money and make good on them for the Indonesians, and take them to what ended up to be the Vatican Bank initially. And they were stolen from him by a guy named Dale Boscos, I think that's something like that. And Dale Boscos is his last name, anyway.
Yeah.
And he made his trip on behalf of the Indonesians, and it's really because of a nephew. No, they didn't want to disclose exactly who he was representing in the Indonesian government, but was somebody like the nephew who inherited his throne or whatever. But what happened was, as I say, these certificates were stolen. And there was a whole plot that was involved in the background of that, involving the Illuminati, and involving a number of key players who were even involved in what we know of as Davos, Switzerland, where they hold this yearly financial, get-together among the very, very rich. there was a plot put into effect to steal these certificates. Now, what Keenan really wanted to do with those certificates, as I found out after investigating, is he wanted to take them to get them involved in what's known as a trading program, a high yield trading program, and the minimum investment is something like $100 million, and you can only do it as an individual, and you're only vetted and you're part of a club, et cetera, et cetera. And this is something that that the White Hats had followed that trail for quite a while and found that it led to funding black projects. But in any rate, the Indonesians were trying to take at least a portion of those certificates or the money represented by those certificate and invest it in one of those trading programs. That is really what Neil Keenan was set out to do. Now, they were not allowed in the club, in essence, and on top of it, the certificates were stolen. What happened was Keenan gave them to this Del Bosco guy who was a representative of the Vatican Bank, who then just stole them. And as one can easily imagine, on behalf of the Vatican Bank. And there is also a couple of players involved. I mean, there's a whole lawsuit that was filed, and then it was actually taken down. Neil Keenan filed the lawsuit in the state of New York, of all places, and then he withdrew it after a certain period of time. But the people that were listed as being part of that involved people like Ban Ki-moon, who was involved in the United Nations, and I think maybe Cheney is also listed in there. I know that there's a number of heavy-duty players that were all involved. So Neil has been trying to, in essence, recover the gold, and I guess is part of a group that wants to do that. But he's had his own problems within the ranks of the people that have worked with him. Now, I interviewed a guy named Michael Dunn not that long ago, maybe 6 months ago, and that interview is available on my YouTube channel and also my live stream channel. For those that are interested, he actually worked with Keenan for a while behind the scenes, crafting his sort of his message. Michael Dunn is a writer, among other things. So I'm not sure what else you want to know about those two characters, but you know, they are players in this arena that we're in. I'm not sure what all they're doing like today in this regard. I know that from time to time Keenan is making announcements via his website saying, you know, something's about to happen or whatever kind of thing. And some of this also stems back, at least in Keenan's case, I think, to the revaluation of certain currencies like the Iraqi dinar that has become so notorious, and so on.
And these certificates that you're talking about, are they from the Marshall Plan when, after World War II, the countries got together and decided to, you know, how they're going to structure the world currency? And then the Federal Reserve was given charge of, you know, ending poverty, stopping environmental destruction, all this stuff. And then they were given certain financial instruments based on Indonesian gold that were given to Indonesia via Federal Reserve certificates. And these certificates were like for billions and billions of dollars that actually ended up getting funneled to like foreign banks who, and like the worst people ever, the top of the elites who use this money for black projects and for helicopters to kill people and stuff like this. And they didn't use any of the money to rebuild, stop environmental destruction and stuff like that. So these certificates are what they're fighting over. Is that correct?
Well, they're certificates, that from my understanding relate to what was buried in the Philippines, I think, if I recall correctly, at the end of World War II by the Japanese, but also hidden in places in Indonesia, and I believe at least one other country, I'm not sure where. The actual original money, the gold and what it symbolizes, I think there are also some precious things, relics and things that were gathered. Some of this stuff came, if you trace it all the way back, from South America, of all places. And the Chinese also have a hand in this, thinking that they and their secret societies were using, in other words, the Indonesians were safeguarding this money on behalf of at least some other groups, such as the Chinese. And the plundering by Japan initially was of monies that the Chinese believe is theirs, but also appears to have come from South America. So it's an extremely convoluted story, and the history is not even agreed upon. So this is where you get into some very contentious stuff. And it really goes off the subject of what I specialize in. So, you know,
I know, it's kind of like follow the money, or there's like this Game of Thrones behind the secret space program. Because if you're trying to build UFOs, if you're trying to do all these black projects and stuff, it's getting funded from somewhere, and it's getting funded by these bizarre certificates based on gold in Indonesia, and you know what I mean? It's just very, trying to put this whole tapestry together is really interesting, and it seems like Karen Hudis and Neil Keenan are both accusing. But were you saying that Neil Keenan was trying to get these certificates to fund black projects instead of for humanity, and Karen Hudis is trying to, like, who's the good guy in this scenario?
No, what I was saying is that the certificates that he had taken with him in the suitcase, first of all, and strangely enough, he contacted one of the Camelot witnesses who I interviewed. And if you haven't seen my interview with Benjamin Fulford, then I highly recommend it. And let me apologize here, because I have jet lag. I just got back from China a week ago, and I'm having the most terrible time trying to get back on my feet in terms of just everyday operations here, because the jet lag is just so intense. I was over in China and Australia speaking there. But to get back to the subject, so Neil Keenan, again, had certificates that the Indonesians wanted to use a portion of what they were worth to get involved in what are called trading programs, which in essence was going to make them a lot more money on their money if it had worked. They simply weren't let in. And that's because the trading programs, first of all, are handled by members of the CIA, who are like the front men. And I've actually gone down this rabbit hole quite a bit, but I can tell you the White Hats are more are expert in this area than I am, by far. And on top of it, these trading programs ultimately are something that Karen Hudis apparently doesn't know about, but she herself was probably bumping up against. And they are talked about to some degree in what's called the Economic Hitman's book, but it involves going into a third world, what appear, you know, seems to be a third world country, although now people call the U.S. a third world country, so it gets a little confusing. And apologize for my cat in the background here; he's playing with a bag.
That's okay.
But anyway, so they go and they go to somewhere like Africa. They say they're going to build them, you know, an oil well or whatever it is. They get the whole thing set up. The person, you know, gets an investment, borrows a lot of money. Then the thing somehow goes bankrupt. And a lot of the kickback is huge for the first year of investment of this, as I said, a minimum of, I believe it's $100 million, if I have my number correct. Minimum investment, and usually it's a lot more than that. And it gets, they get a huge return, a percentage of return, the person who initially invests, and then it cuts off all of a sudden. And then they get cut off altogether. The project usually starts out as a so-called humanitarian gesture and ends up to be to bankrupt an African country or wherever it happens to be, and they end up owing the IMF a huge amount of money and being indebted to them, and then in essence what you have is a takeover scenario by countries that are running the IMF, which is the Rothschild, you know, Brits and Americans and so on. So it's the trading programs are the backbone of all of that as well. But they also there also has been evidence now that these huge trading programs that are going on as we speak, and the FBI denies that they exist, by the way, has gone in to fund black projects in a big way. And you know, what happened was the white hats that I got to know quite well, at least two of the principals involved in this group that calls themselves the white hats, that were made up of intelligence agency agents, both ex-intel agents and current, as well as retired military and current military across around the world, have gotten into a network, and they called themselves the White Hats. There was a particular group that was kind of orchestrating some disclosures that were happening for about 2 years, and now it's been about 2 years since they stopped publishing. But what they used to do is publish evidence of fraud and all the financial documents, and they had gone down the rabbit trail in terms of these trading programs, and actually found an organization, a front company called Pure Heart Investments, that was a major player in this arena, and have documentation proving that. They were about to publish it in what they called Number 48. This was about 2 years ago. I was asked to come forward and write, you know, in essence, what they found again was that this money was going into being funneled into black projects. So I was asked to write a report on black projects, what they were, describing them, etc. And I did write a report over a weekend, and then they were about to publish on a Monday, and they got a phone call telling them that if they published their information, that they would be killed. So they decided to stop, to live to fight another day, so to speak. And they've been pretty quiet ever since. Although I did get one of them, Paladin, as he's known by that name, to write a column from time to time on my Project Camelot website.
There, I came across a website called formerwhitehat.wordpress.com, and one of the blog entries, I don't know if this is real.
That's different. That is a completely different operation. That was, let's see, his name is Hemmingson. I believe Michael Hemmingson was his name. And he supposedly died, by the way.
There's one blog entry where they mention you. They mention you in a lot of these blog entries. One of the blog entries is about they claim that you interviewed a woman called Miriam Delcato, and then you had dinner with her, and then after dinner, a bunch of Miriam Delcato's clones came out of an SUV and tried to abduct you. Is that true?
I know. Well, you have to understand who Michael Hemmingson is or was. Now, he apparently, it's said that he died actually not that long ago. And if he really did die, I'm really sorry to hear that. So let me say that right off. I did interview him on my radio show. He did deny being the creator of the former White Hat website. Now, that was a spoof on the whole UFO community and all the players in it, and done very creatively and intelligently by Michael. And he also claimed that he had some other people who were co-writing on it eventually and helping him out with what he in essence was writing were sort of mini characterizations of the various players like David Wilcock, myself, Bill Ryan, and countless others. He got into a huge, you know, war of words with Duncan O'Finian. But what he would claim are things that were completely off, completely, like, so crazy that, like, what I'm supposed to have, what he said was, he actually said pretty nice things about me, which was, I was one of the few people he was nice to, from what I understand. He said really horrendous things. I mean, you know, like, the people were axe murderers or, you know, All you know, they murdered their lover, or they did this, or they did that. But in my case, I'm supposed to have on Procyon a husband and children waiting for me. I go to Catalina Island, and I take some kind of UFO, and you know, leave the planet every now and again. At some point, he did say there were clones of Miriam, but he also said there were clones of me at some point, and then he took it back. At one point, he thought I was abducted and taken, I don't know, off planet or something like that. And then when I showed up again, because I'd actually been traveling in England or whatever on a speaking tour, he actually, you know, had to take that back and say, well, actually, they found her and she wasn't, you know, abducted or something. But yeah, people, strangely enough, just are so naive in this sector, they will believe anything, and there's no logical thought involved. And he just, you know, he's an author. He's written, I don't know, 10 or more books. He is related to Anaïs Nin, who is a famous sort of 19th century novelist who was famous for her erotica, I think you call it, and you know, I think she's read in colleges and so on. She's quite a wonderful writer.
So he made like a satirical Onion news network about all your Project Camelot stuff, basically. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, if you want to call it that. You know, and I found him amusing. Some people wanted to kill him, and were not amused. So, you know, because it was, in essence, you know, disparaging them and their reputation. And people believe this stuff, which is wild in itself. So that's that story.
Well, yeah, okay. So, but have you, I mean, you've been ruffling some big feathers. Have you had your, I'm sure you've had your own threats constantly, and, you know?
Well, yes, I have had, although there's been, you know, it's pretty limited. I had a very specific, what you might say after the fact, death threat. Although on a psychic level, I had gotten the message anyway. After the Pete Peterson interview, we have a whistleblower called Pete Peterson who's spent probably most of his life, at least 40 years in the Secret Space Program. He's a kind of, we call him a kind of a Doctor Who of the Secret Space Program. He's an inventor slash physicist slash just brilliant. Hands down brilliant guy, who we interviewed over a weekend. As it happened, it was me, my former partner, Bill Ryan, and David Wilcock, who all went to visit this man, who spent the entire weekend. The man talked nonstop. He had been so dying to communicate what he'd come across to the public that he actually didn't stop talking. He was still talking at like 4 a.m. when we were sitting around a table falling asleep. And then he would be up the next morning at, you know, 8 or 9 a.m. and then talking again. So we heard from him off the record for at least, actually 3 days. And then on the Monday, about the Monday afternoon, he finally turned to us and said, okay, now you can turn on the cameras. What happened was, David did a section, Bill did a section, and then I did a section. My section was, he took great offense to it. He wanted me to remove it, and so on. And, you know, you can listen to it. You can watch it and see that he says to me a number of times, I ask him a question, and he gives what I call a denial of a denial, which in essence is saying something is true. He was the person who told us about Skynet, the Skynet chip and the Terminator reality basically being real for all intents and purposes. And he worked in MKUltra. He would deny that, but that appears to be the information we have, as well as other things. So that's a very interesting interview. And I did get a direct threat. They were going to kill me over that interview, apparently. Not to give too much detail, but basically someone intervened on my behalf, supposedly. But then we have had other sort of not so overt threats as well. At one point, we went to Florida to interview a certain witness with regard to a certain disclosure. And we got a phone call partway through that process that basically said that we had to leave town and that if we disclosed anything, certain parties would die. And so it goes. So, I mean, we've also had things like the wheel fall off our car. That was a clear, clean break on, I guess, what you call an Audi station wagon. That was a very dependable old car that had been checked out before we took the trip up on the top of the Swedish, not the Swiss Alps, in Grindelwald area. So that was another incident. We've had a number of tires blow where we're driving on the freeway and so on in suspicious situations. We always get attacked. I mean, I've been attacked nonstop whenever I do anything. Have had multiple attacks electronically and various other things go on.
Dr. Pete Peterson, I saw your interview with Erin Rothschild, and she was saying that her son had a handler that you had interviewed. I wonder if Dr. Pete Peterson was that handler, and I think you do as well, right?
Dr. Pete Peterson is handled. He was called back to the Pentagon right after our interview, and you could probably say that he was debriefed and maybe reprogrammed at that time. His wife died not too long, about a year later. You could say that was a synchronicity or not. Now, as far as him being a handler, Bill Brockbrader believed, in essence, that he was trying to handle him. There seemed to be some kind of a negotiation going on back channel in that regard. But I don't think he's not really a handler in an official capacity, although he did identify Duncan O'Finian as being an original super soldier, and apparently Duncan recognized him.
Now, as far as handlers, for my audience, I interview a lot of comedians. I only go down rabbit holes so much, so I'm exposing myself to being, you know, all this stuff. MK Ultra is basically, you know, a mind control thing. And when you have a handler, that's the person that is administering mind control. A lot of celebrities have quote unquote handlers all the time that are with them all the time that never leave their side. And they're making sure that their sort of mind control programming is sticking. And there's declassified CIA documents that say that they have to really control Hollywood and make sure that they're putting out the right message. Because if someone like Will Smith or if someone like Jim Carrey starts talking about 9/11 was an inside job, that's not a good look for the U.S. government, you know? So they have to make sure that they get people that are in a certain box. But
it's important to understand that Pete Peterson was a much higher level operative than that. He is an inventor. He's he's a scientist. So he's not going around handling people. You know, he just simply might have been used to sort of help someone out at a certain point because he was, let's say, positioned in a certain way. And he's also has been semi-retired. Now he has recently been, in essence, reactivated, and has been given a fair amount of money to continue his work. I'd like to say that he's gone to work for the good side of humanity, but I'm not at all convinced of that. I don't know, but I can tell you that it's. That there's no two ways about it. He has been given some money and some backing at this point to resume his operations. Mm.
And there's also whistleblowers like Savali, like Bryce Taylor, like some other people that say this exact same story of how mind control is administered and how it operates. So look into Bryce Taylor and and Savali. Savali, she also brings up interesting stuff. There's...
Yes, we have a very long publication on our site of Savali material.
Yeah. Now, I want to make a phrase, and I want you to connect the dots here. I'd say that Dulce, the secret space program, Freemasonry, the Illuminati, gray aliens, every intelligence agency in the world, the Vatican, and there's one person that connects all of those institutions, and that's Aleister Crowley.
Well, I mean, he's linked up because of who he was in terms of the background. So, yeah, I guess you could make that supposition.
What is the occult, and Satanism comes up a lot. What is the occult and Aleister Crowley style Satanism involved? Like, you interviewed that OTO guy recently who was wearing that weird cap, and he was talking about he was, outwardly an OTO member, and also the government loves people like that. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure who you're referring to. If you mean Richard Allen Miller, who is a magus and is a member of OTO and is, considered in essence a master magician, unfortunately from the dark side, but he apparently has turned over to the light. He has a background in all of that. But there is also, we interviewed Leo Zagami, who's very heavily involved in the P2 Lodge and the Black Pope and all of that. So he's also was disclosing about that many years ago. And then there have been a few others that have come out in that regard. I think James Wright is another one, and there's a few others. Anyway,
Richard Allen Miller.
I mean, what is your question again? I'm not sure. What are you trying to say? I mean, cult is basically anything that's... A cult simply means secret, but we're really talking about secret societies, and we're talking about a secret, in essence, bloodline, which it all goes back to, that comes from a certain ET lineage that goes back to the time before Sumeria and also Egypt. So the roots go all the way back to that time. Now, certainly Crowley wasn't alive, at least as Crowley, back in those days. And I'm sure he fully believes he was reincarnated a number of times. I have studied the occult in a fair amount of depth, and I do know a lot about Crowley. What can I say? I mean, I'm not sure if you ask me a specific question, it'd probably be a little easier to try to answer.
Okay, I guess what I'm getting at is, like, you would think that if you wanted to get into the secret space program, and sure, like, you can be an MIT scientist and go out up this way, but I think also if you go into these weird Freemasonic lodges, or if you go into an OTO, which is the Oro Temple Orientalis, as Richard Allen Miller has done, all of a sudden, these black projects, like, if you get high enough in the levels of the occult, then they all of a sudden want your opinion and stuff and want to give you money for stuff. Why are these people the ones who are farmed, the occult members, the ones who are farmed for these black projects?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not done quite the way you're just suggesting that it is. I mean, that would be kind of an ass backwards way of looking at it, in my opinion. Bottom line is they do track our children, and they've been doing this for quite some time. They do look for children, especially in certain bloodlines, and they follow their trajectory, their progress in school, their aptitude, etc. And they are looking for what are, in essence, the Illuminati bloodline, which has a large reptilian part. And they also are related to, the race from Aldebaran is probably mixed in with a lot of them. I would say there are also factions that are really more reptilian than not, like the Bushes, whereas there are other factions that are related directly to the Anunnaki. And that's a whole saga in itself. So, You're talking about a bloodline search, and that's the first thing they would do. Then the next thing is they watch the child. In Pete Peterson's case, and in the case of Henry Deacon, they followed him through his schooling. They may steer you, especially if you're in a military family. They often look for those children as being already sort of conditioned in a certain way. They're brought up. I mean, if you hear the interview I did with the woman who calls herself, well, she's Erin Rothschild, but also Green Hutt or Green something is her last name, you know, who was brought up in one of those Illuminati families and was tortured, etc., which they are oftentimes. You know, so that is the pool by which they are looking for talent, if you will. Then they do spread out into all different areas. I mean, they are tracking every child now, in case the child has special abilities, you know, in terms of beyond the sixth senses, as well as aptitude in the sciences, etc. So that's where they get their recruits, if you will. Now, they are the dark side. So it's important to understand that for the most part, the secret space program, the secret government, is run by individuals who are on the highest level, first of all, interacting with ETs, who are also on the dark side. But they have, again, the what seems predominant is the reptilian genes, which is all about power over others, Satanism, bloodlust, you know, and all those things that go with that. So that's their sort of way of operating. And then on top of it, the agendas that I've already mentioned earlier in the show. Now, what happened also was that inadvertently, of course, they've recruited a number of people who then have risen through the ranks and have also become what we know of as white hats, which are sometimes they're Illuminati members who just want to defect, who didn't want to be in the Illuminati to begin with, were born into that, you know, bloodline, into that. You know, their parents may be big Illuminati members and so on. But those are the members that will progress in not just in the secret space program, but also in places in you know, in the surface government, as we know of it, and in the Ivy League schools like Harvard, etc. They're always going to be given precedence over, say, people that are more of what they might term mixed blood. So it's more a process like that. That yields what, you know, in essence is their members.
And look at the royal family. They're so concerned about who's got the right blood, who's got the best blood. And isn't that like racism? Isn't that like, oh, we're supposed to believe that the Queen of England has like better blood than other people and everybody else is just not as good? Like, isn't that exactly what racism is? So I guess,
well, of course, but they, you know, they specialize. I mean, that's where the Nazis come from. I mean, the Illuminati are Nazis, so don't be mistaken about that either. They're both Satanists and Nazis. In fact, there are splits within the Illuminati itself in terms of favoring the one side over the other. According to Dan Burish, at some point that, you know, some people don't even want to be in the same room with the blood drinkers, so to speak. Some are fundamentalist Christians that don't want to drink blood, you know, and then there's the other side. I mean, of course it's racist. That's the nature of the beast.
So crazy. And, like, you know, my awakening basically happened after watching Stephen Jones talk at BYU about dust in the Trade Center, and then you realize, once you realize that, you know, the Trade Center was blown up, and then you for the process of going and stealing oil and going and stealing resources and just having endless wars, then you're like, well, what's the religion of these people? And it seems to, you know, then you start asking questions, and, you know, now I'm like, I never say no to any information. I always, you know what I mean? What was your what was your deprogramming like? Because we see through the interviews, your early interviews, you don't have the knowledge base that you have now. So what did you know what was going on before Camelot? Or obviously Camelot exceeded your, you know, you grew in knowledge from there, but when did you have like an awakening that things were not as they seemed?
Well, I don't know, because strangely, I would say that I came in with that knowledge. I was never a very naive child. I was always aware. I had, a lot of psychic awareness when I was young. I also, nothing surprises me, even in Camelot, and never did over the years, I have to say, on some strange level. For the most part, I even came across some books on the occult when I was like 12 years old and like knew it and got it. I have to say that I just came in from, with kind of what you might say a thin veil in terms of my past life information. So it wasn't, I never was just a person who believed that this was what it appears to be. I always knew there was an unseen world, so to speak, and that it involved, angels, demons, and all kinds of other kinds of entities, etc. I can say that, there have been times where, I've gotten more verification in a sort of out and out, incontrovertible way that actually, I guess you might say, strengthened me over the years to get the validation of everything I'd ever thought to be correct, was correct, or is playing out to be correct. So that kind of thing was very empowering. So a lot of people ask me, don't you get depressed over this information? And actually, I find it energizing. Because I believe that, we came in here to fight a battle, and I've never doubted that. So it's always been my point of view. In fact, I was really a fighter since I was a kid. I was always rebelling against authority and always questioning everything. And I used to read a lot as a kid as well. I hated cartoons, for example, and used to do nothing but read instead. I just wasn't the normal kid, really, as far as I know. But there have been some things. Like one thing I used to do was I was in complete denial about reptilians being real. So as much as I believed in all this other stuff, like this sort of other world, I guess, it took me a long time to believe that there were such things as reptilians until I actually saw one. I've told this story many times, but just for the record, I was about to go into a meditation. It was a few years before I started Camelot, and I had, the television series V, had been on, this is the early version, not the more recent version, I think it was, and, years before that. And at the time I had thought, oh God, this is so stupid. Why do they always make these evil ones, reptilians? I just can't believe that there, are beings walking around that are reptilians. And so then I wasn't thinking about this at all at the time. And I was just going to go into a meditation. And then I saw, as I have had done a ton of meditation and connected my chakras, etc., I can at times see interdimensionally. And I suddenly saw this, what we call a shikar, fly by me, which was a conscious being and was quite large, and I was seeing into an interdimensional space. And for some reason, I didn't block it out from my mind at that moment. I actually saw him, and I was conscious that he was seeing me, and that, he was a fairly fearsome being, if you will, although I didn't feel particularly afraid of him in any way. But I from that point on, I knew that I had been wrong and that these creatures fully, did exist. And then I've had other I've seen some others in sort of dream visions and things. So of other kinds, because there's more than one type of reptilian.
Wow. So we're wrapping up. I won't keep you for too much longer, but I wanted to ask you about this. The New York Times recently said that ISIS is funded by the CIA. You interviewed a guy called Scott Bennett who said that specifically UBS, I'm not sure if he named it, but he said Swiss banks. I'm assuming he means the UBS was funding ISIS, and they arrested him. And but there's still like other news outlets that are putting out that ISIS is this evil terrorist network that we have to fight against and have endless war against. And so do you see that, like, finally we're kind of seeing, like, the sputtering out of the cabal control? Because the New York Times had been controlled by these cabal, putting out false information. But now they're saying that ISIS is funded by the CIA. It's all bullshit. We're funding our own enemy to fight against. You confirm that with this guy, Scott Bennett. So do you see that they're eventually, like, when the news organizations aren't getting the story straight, when they're not pumping out the party line anymore, clearly something is wrong and the cabal seems to be split, and maybe this is a good opportunity to see if we can defeat them and stop the suppression of free energy technology, which is something I'm really a proponent of. You know, so do you see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and if we keep fighting this, we can have this cabal go away? What do you think about this?
Well, I happen to think it's a lot more complex than that. I don't think that, you know, that the New York Times has suddenly seen the light, so to speak. Now, if they are, you know, publishing such a story, which has been disclosed elsewhere, specifically not only on my website, but also on Veterans Today, then it simply means that, you know, the competition is getting really fierce in the alternative sector, and the alternative sector is really the one that is breaking the stories at this point. The major mainstream media has been so derelict that it's become like a laughing stock. So I think that they're having to spice things up a bit, and there are certain things that they can get away with. Now, I am not one of those people who think that the cabal is packing their stuff up and just going to abdicate the throne, so to speak, of running the world without a fight anytime soon. So I'm not one of those people. And in fact, I think that that is part of the plot to get New Ager types to let their guard down and to think that it's all hearts and flowers, and therefore you don't have to defend the sovereign, you know, sacred land or sovereign space of humanity and the earth. So, I mean, there are a lot of agendas out there. None of those, the Illuminati types that I know of, are going to pack their bags. They have splits within them, that's for sure, and that does allow you know, what we call the white hats, the people behind the scenes that are appearing to be members of some of those organizations, to help us more behind the scenes. And I do think that we're gaining traction because the consciousness on planet Earth is waking up. And so I think it's more a case that as people begin to wake up and demand more, even just in terms of consciousness, that it changes the equation on planet Earth, and that they're having to deal with that. There's also a certain energetics that we're going through right now that's facilitating the change in consciousness, and also activating Kundalini or Orgone energy in humans, so that humans are becoming, you know, they're aging less, their DNA is turning on, and a lot of it is the so-called junk DNA is being activated. So we're going through, as a species, we're going through a whole change. That change means that the Illuminati and those, the so sort of drive to keep us from on a lower vibration, in essence, isn't working as well as it used to. They are escalating things as a consequence. So, you know, you could see it as every time we gain in power, they do have to do something even more to try to even the playing field. So it's kind of a neck and neck struggle in the way I see it at this time. I don't see them backing down. And I think that it's going to go on for a number of more years here on planet Earth. But I do see that it certainly things are improving in terms of consciousness of humanity, and that's the good news.
Right. Wow. Well, thank you so much for this interview. This has been really a pleasure for me. I just want to give you a little bit about my background. I'm in grad school for screenwriting right now, and so if you ever want to collaborate on a screenplay or you want to throw a draft my way or something, feel free to do that. Kerry Cassidy, you're a hero of mine. You're a national treasure, and you know, you're fighting a good fight. What, you're on the front lines of trying to blow apart the security levels to keep everybody in the dark, and you're a big part of you know, helping everybody understand what the hell's going on so that, you know, consciousness can be raised via the internet, via free information out there, you know? So you're a beautiful lady. I really appreciate what you're doing. And thank you so much for this interview.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for the very kind words. And so, yeah, it's great that you're writing, you know, part of a screenplay or film program. That's awesome. And, you know, I think film is a very good tool by which to enlighten the masses. And there are a lot of truth being put out even by the so-called mainstream media and large artists. There's still a lot of artists in Hollywood even working to get information out behind the scenes in the form of fiction and music as well. So thank you for the interview. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we have a similar goal. My next thing is going to be about Dulce. But, you know, I have a background as a comic, so I'm trying to make everything entertaining and funny at the same time as exposing some darker truth like George Carlin or something like this. Anyway, I could talk to you for another 3 hours. You're so interesting. Thank you so much for this interview, and signing off. Thank you.
All right. All right. You take care, and thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's another episode of Highway Diary in the bag. Thanks to my guest, Kerry Cassidy. This has been crazy. We talked for an hour, 26 minutes. What a great lady. See you next time, guys. Oh, yeah, click through the Amazon link and the Highway Diary RSS feed. It kicks a little bit of money to this program. And I should also, in this winter break, I'll post more stand-up dates. So anyway, see you later. Bye.